You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Craig Hodgetts. Craig, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Well, thanks for calling.
Craig, I'm excited to talk about a number of aspects about architecture and what you're involved in, and I'd love to talk about the Hyperloop and as well as the amphitheater you're working on and the whole plate that an architect is dealing with. Maybe we should begin with the amphitheater project. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how it was built?
This amphitheater was actually, I guess it came about because of the Hollywood Bowl, which we had designed some years ago. And it was just a call from the city of Nashville. And it turned out the mayor was about to go out and wanted to leave behind a legacy. And what else would be a legacy in Music City except an amphitheater? So we began work on that and had to find a kind of image that would resonate with Music City. And we came upon an old Gretsch guitar amplifier, and that proved to be the kind of form language, the design language, which we employed for the entire amphitheater complex. So it was kind of fortuitous that somebody named Gretsch had made this object way the heck back in 1950 and inspired us.
And it's one thing to get inspired by a form, but an amphitheater, I would think, has the incredibly complex issue of sound and good sound. And I don't know if that's straightforward, but it was always my understanding that wasn't something that was straightforward, especially when trying to, create a kind of structure as you're talking around based on an idea.
Well, actually, it turns out that acoustics in an outdoor space are far less predictable than they are in interior space. And I think what brought us some renown in the Hollywood Bowl was that we devised a computer-controlled canopy that could respond to barometric pressure, wind, things of that order, humidity, to fine-tune the sound in an exterior environment. So the technology of an amphitheater, ranges all the way from stage mechanics to acoustical mechanics, and it's very, very stimulating and exciting to work on, almost like working on a spaceship at a certain level.
That's fascinating. And so with this project, those same ideas were employed, a similar type of canopy?
Actually, in this case, we opted for an electronic, quote-unquote, canopy, dealing with computers and delays to create an appropriate resonance. So each case is different, and we knew that we were dealing with amplified music in Nashville, where the Hollywood Bowl, of course, is dealing with acoustic music, such as an orchestra has. So there, again, it's kind of a vast terrain that you've got to be on a very, very steep learning curve all the time to just, be a player. It's exciting.
It is exciting. And, there's a number of things that I know you're working on, but the Hyperloop is also a project that maybe some people who are hearing this know but don't. That also seems like a very exciting and kind of a behemoth of a project as well.
Well, I probably have to acquaint you with the components of the Hyperloop. It was an idea first floated by Elon Musk, and although it was actually first floated in a subterranean vacuum tube transport on Wall Street area in New York in about 1910. They built about a mile of such a thing. But, of course, technology wasn't up to the task at that point.
They built that in New York and near Wall Street?
They sure did. Lots of etchings.
And what did they build exactly? Because I've never heard of that. That sounds fascinating.
They built a vacuum tube transport underground in a stone tunnel, and they had very, very attractive parlor cars, which went through it, and it was marketed as a kind of thrill ride at the time. And it did, in fact, function, but it didn't function in a reliable enough manner to morph into a transportation network. It was floating.
And how did that function? Was it similar to the ideas behind the current one, or how was that functioning?
Well, if you imagine those vacuum tubes in a department store, where you insert a capsule into a tube and it's sort of propelled by a vacuum, the same principle is what was used for this train. But if you ratchet your mind back to 1910 and try to think about what was available in terms of electric power to power the fans, sealants in order to maintain the vacuum, et cetera, it was not technically reliable enough to actually function. But the project we're working on now is composed of a tube about 9 to 12 feet in diameter and a capsule which fits within the tube. Passengers, about 30 passengers per capsule, and a rate of launching of every 30 to 45 seconds. So rather than a very, very long train, it's a just-in-time kind of transportation device. You arrive at the station, you proceed directly to the capsule, and the capsule, within a period of 2 to 4 minutes, takes off on its 500, 600-mile trip, so that there's none of the delay and frustration which happens at traditional transportation centers. This is kind of on-demand transit, more like a subway, except it's much more lengthy. It's solar-powered, and it's minimal footprint environmentally, because within the tube zaps across, farmlands and other landscapes, barely touching the ground and not inhibiting, farmlands, tractors, and so forth and so on from continuing to plow the fields. So and also, of course, because you're in a tube, there's very, very little chance of an accident, a truck sitting on the tracks or something like that. So you just go through the advantages and check, 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 and it becomes something quite sublime and likely to succeed in the in both the third world and in the civilized world.
I mean, that's kind of it still seems such an extraordinary idea. So to talk about how it would ideally work, when you say it would run through farmlands and fields and, I imagine in hundreds of miles, this is built on an elevated track? And
yes,
is that
right.
Why there's still, yeah. And how fast will this go?
Roughly 700 miles an hour. And it's not fantasy. That's the amazing thing. as work progresses, there are proof of concept experiments going on with the suspension system, the air supplies. They have a major provider of vacuum systems that built the collider in France to provide the vacuum in the tube, and are set on, this is Hyperloop Transportation Technologies. They are set on building the first 5-mile mule prototype in Northern California next year. So it's happening.
So in Northern California, a 5-mile prototype will be built. Will that be the first time that you've actually seen it tested? Has it ever been tested or done previous to that?
No, certainly not. There are various experiments going on, as I say, with the suspension system and with maintaining the vacuum in the tube. But it turns out the biggest technical challenges are, to one degree or another, building the tube itself, because if you're going to build a superhighway or a normal train roadbed, there's all kinds of machinery out there that's already designed and implemented to do that. To build a tube, even 5 miles of a tube, is a very, very big task. And the machinery to do it has to be invented and designed and built. The tube production itself has to be solidified. So there are challenges in terms of actually implementing it, but the lesser ones turn out to be like the capsule, because what we're imagining is, and we've been in contact with Bombardier and other companies, it's basically an executive aircraft without wings. It's a pressurized cabin to hold about 30 people. So there's ready accessibility of that aspect. But some of the others at the station, some of the mechanics of dealing with the input and output of the capsules, how do you turn them around? No prototypes exist whatsoever. So those are the ones that are requiring, a kind of, alchemical mix of architects, engineers, and other scientists to resolve some of those issues.
But do working models exist so you could actually see how it might work? I know there's been stations designed by the students and team you're working with, as I understand it, but has there been a working model, or is there such a thing?
No, not at full scale. This 5 mile stretch will be that, because you can't there's a big chicken and egg issue. You can't test it until you've got a vacuum tube. And the tube is such a major driver of the cost of the system that a lot of engineering and design effort is going into the tube, simply because when you begin to build hundreds of miles of tube, let's say between Dubai and somewhere across the desert, that's the significant capital investment.
And at the moment, what is that tube made out of?
Well, there are two alternatives going. One is a pre-stressed concrete extrusion, and the other is a rolled steel. Think Carl Andre, the sculptor, when you think about the rolled steel piece. And then there are sort of side investigations of carbon fiber and more exotic materials. But until we've kind of determined that the other ones have flamed out, I don't think we'll make a big effort into the exotic materials.
And this is a project that, I would imagine, unlike many architectural projects, this is one that would literally change the way we move in the world. It would change an awful lot about how we live, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's really extraordinary in that sense to be a participant in something which is changes the game, and that is in fact so disruptive. So we've done some studies, comparing, let's say, aircraft travel capacity with the capacity of the Hyperloop system in these 400 to 500 mile stretches. And, when you begin to analyze the end-to-end time from taking an airplane, counting in the arrival at the terminal, security, scheduling, waiting for your plane, etc., you're saving probably millions of man hours a year just right there. So it's, the economics are just crazy.
Well, the speed is crazy. Going from, what is it, New York to California would be, how long is that at 700 miles an hour?
That's about 4 hours.
So that's, you know, that's that would change the way we, I would imagine, just I mean, it's almost commutable. No, I mean, not really.
Well,
but I mean,
no, certainly between the what Dirk Allborn, the CEO, is calling the city pairs, which ideally are in this sort of 400 to 500 mile range, you're really talking about, you know, less than an hour to go from L.A. to San Francisco. And so it's quite possible to go for dinner and a show and return, quite possible to go for a business meeting and return. So one of the things that we're hopeful is that this will sort of enable a lot more FaceTime, literally face-to-face time, in all those transactions, and you know, fuel a really different kind of social network as well.
And what would the experience be like? I imagine that there would be kind of G-forces or something, because we're not talking about a slow acceleration. Right.
You know,
I mean, this is a very, very fast acceleration too, isn't it?
The acceleration we're holding down to 1.25 G's. So that's moderate. That's like takeoff in an airplane. And it will reach speed in you know, 20 miles or so. But the G-forces in turning are also similarly limited. And what we discovered is that a turning radius, for those engineers and other nerds in your audience, it will be 15 miles to make a right turn. I mean, radius for any kind of deviation from a straight line. So you're going to be have to be extremely, you know, sort of meticulous in laying out the route. And so there are certain city pairs where it's far more feasible, and others where it would be a heroic act to get between some city pairs because of terrain and other obstacles. It's pretty much a straight line device.
So when you're in it, though, I mean, you're controlling the G forces, but nevertheless, you're feeling the effect of that speed, even in a, you know, what sounds like a very gentle curve or turn. Will that be something we get used to? Is that's different than any kind of experience we've ever had in transportation? Correct.
Well, I think again that the aircraft analog is similar. For instance, when an aircraft is turning and banking to make a landing, we've all experienced those transfers of our weight a little bit. And once at the terminal velocity, the sensation will, in fact, we imagine, and we're fairly certain, will be even smoother than an airplane, because there aren't any disruptions from, you know, air pockets and things of that nature. So once you are, in fact, traveling at your 700 miles an hour or so, we don't imagine anything other than a turn imposing any forces whatsoever.
And so just like a plane, you can get up and walk around and
Well, that's a good question. At this point, the design was based initially on Musk's idea, which was you kind of strap yourself into a recliner, and there's no facilities on board at all. You simply maintain your seat for the entire duration of the trip. But we have introduced a center aisle in the prototype that we're looking at, so that yes, you would be able to get up, but it's going to be quite cramped. It's like a Concorde supersonic jetliner. It's very, very compact. So what we're substituting instead is kind of very novel entertainment systems and a a unique, never-before type experience video portal, which corrects for parallax by tracking your eye motion, so that you do get an experience of depth, even though you're looking at a video monitor.
So explain that to me. I don't understand that exactly. That sounds very interesting. So these are movies people are watching?
No, a company has prototype this video screen technology. You know, when you look out a window, and if you change your point of view, there's a palpable change in the depth of field and all of those things, which you don't get if you look at a normal video, at your screen on your laptop. So this technology monitors your eye movements and corrects the perspective and the depth of field and the direction of your gaze within the plane of the image, so that it in fact responds to your gaze much as looking out through a real window does. And this is one of the devices that we're planning to use in the capsule.
Well, that sounds like an extraordinary kind of advance in itself. Has there been prototypes of that you're looking
that
at?
Oh, yes, yeah, I've experienced that. It works great.
And what is the experience when you're looking at that? Do you feel in control? You're looking around. Are you interacting with that kind of with
your
eyes in a way that you know?
Yeah, but you're unaware that it is interacting with you. You're just simply looking out the window and looking sort of ahead or looking sort of behind, because there's no possibility of views out of this tube. But just as there is in an airplane, we want to introduce this sensation of other space into the cabin, and this seems to be the best way to do it.
So does that mean that unlike in a plane where there's an entertainment kind of or screen of some kind in front of you, in a capsule which has no windows in it, there are perhaps video screens where there would be windows and it would have the kind of technology that you're talking about? That's where it would exist?
That technology I'm talking about would exist where there might be windows, just so that there's a sensation of space and travel. And then the other entertainment systems we're looking at have to do with various projections and interactive projections. So one of the things we've talked about is, let's say you're traveling with your child, and he or she is a big Spider-Man fan. Spider-Man might be sitting in his seat that is destined for the child and get up and say hi. All managed through an advanced computer network. So one of the things that's most exciting about this venture is that it seems to be a magnet to pull innovative ideas from all over the world and package them within one experience. So the entire spectrum is open. So it's not bound by, any of the detritus from the past. Every element, station design, capsule design, etc., is a fresh challenge and presents the opportunity to integrate and make a holistic experience out of it. That's really go ahead.
No, that's fantastic. It's that I didn't realize there was that much going into it. It's a whole different experience. And when you gave the example of Spider-Man getting up, I mean, how has that happened? Because he's the seat itself also is an imaging device that you can present.
Well, what we played with is what's called it's a kind of front projection system. projection mapping is what it's called. And we did prototype this with one of the things that the students were doing, and it worked fantastically well. So this will be, you know, one of the technologies that hopefully is built into the finished product.
And then what are you seeing in the place of where the windows are? What kind of imagery would come by there? I mean, of course, typically I just think of, you know, landscapes or something, but what would the imagery be? Because it could be literally anything, right?
Well, that's true, and that's not, at this point, we really haven't projected our minds that far into what is the content. Obviously, there would be content providers, but, you know, I just saw these ads for, you may have seen them for on PBS for the audio books where they transport you to different environments conceptually in your mind. And I was seeing those, and I said, yeah, you could be going through a future city. You could be going through a star field. You could be going through a rural landscape. All of those things, you know, from a psychological position, will need to be really pretty carefully orchestrated, because what we're imagining is that the function of all of these things will be, in fact, to make the experience pleasurable, but we're not looking at it as, you know, a theme park ride or something that is stimulating. We're hoping that it's calming and you can read your ebook. Does that make
right.
sense?
Right. I think you'd have to write it a lot of times to feel that way. I imagine as calming as you make it, it would be an extraordinary first ride.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm sure looking forward to that first ride.
Well, so that will happen next year. That will be
the plan is to break ground next year. Yeah.
And right now, the funding from all this is entirely private. Is that the
it's
case?
It's entirely private. Yeah. And that has to do also with the, you know, the burden of all the regulatory infrastructure, which, you know, in itself is a hurdle. So this very first mule, the first test track, will actually be licensed as an amusement, and it will not be licensed as a transportation device.
Because that's a much stricter code to meet?
Yes, of course. Suddenly you've got the whole federal government involved.
Right. And I suppose issues of accidents or problems are difficult to manage because, of course, an accident with this would be more catastrophic than normal.
Well, that's true. Although right now the risk assessment, which is being done by a company called AECOM, is that on a, you know, passenger mile basis, it would be considerably safer than an aircraft, and way, way safer than driving.
That makes sense. You know, when we were talking a little earlier off the record, you were saying how one of the exciting things about being an architect is, you know, there's all these things on your plate, so to speak, that you're managing. It sounds like the Hyperloop is an example of that, because it seems that, as you were saying, all these kind of technologies and ideas can be brought into that. But is that what you meant, or?
Yes, that's exactly what I meant. As a career, I mean, you could obviously take a fork in that road and look at providing, you know, things that are more along a kind of standardized path. But the activity of an architect is you know, sort of conceptually spread all across, you know, just about every human activity. And so if you open yourself up to that and, you know, let that spirit of experimentation and innovation sort of be your guiding principle, then it's a rocket ship. It's just a lot of fun.
It does. It sounds like one of the more exciting projects you could possibly be involved in. It's the kind of thing when I, you know, talk to my 15-year-old son who's always wants to know what is the future? What could possibly be new? This is one of these ideas that is truly life-changing.
Yep. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
Craig, it's been a pleasure talking with you. I want to thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me to your program.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.